Good evening and welcome to the May 2019 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. Our first order on our agenda is the approval of the minutes of our last meeting, which was April the 8th. Did everybody get a chance to look at the minutes? And anybody have any comments, corrections, or suggestions? Okay, if not, we will ask Teresa to do the things that she does with them and publish them where they need to be published. At this point in our agenda, we will ask for public comment. Any persons in our audience that wishes to speak on issues other than anything that we have as a scheduled item on the agenda but are within the scope of the interest of the Health Commission, if they would come forward. Seeing no one come forward, we will go to our first presentation for this evening. So we have with us Nicholas Drews, who's the program manager, too, for the San Luis Obispo Health Agency. Nick is going to address health information exchange for us this evening. So we are excited to have you with us. Thank you for coming. There you go, when the red light comes on.
Now you can hear me.
All right. Okay.
Hello, thank you for having me. The first thing I wanted to mention was give you an introduction of myself. So my name is Nick Drews. I'm the program manager for the health applications program at the health agency that oversees our two HRs. The first one is on the public health side, and the other one is on our behavioral health side. So we have two systems. Part of the role as well is getting that information, potentially sharing it with the public, as well as sharing it with other providers in order to improve clinical services. So what I wanted to talk with you about today, or I was invited to discuss with you today, is about the health information exchange, so an HIE. As you'll notice on the screen, this is the official definition from the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. So HIE allows doctors, nurses, pharmacists, other healthcare providers, and patients to appropriately access and securely share a patient's vital medical information electronically, improving the speed, quality, safety, cost of patient care. There's a simpler way to say it. So all of you who work in the medical field probably use an electronic health record system. The HIE allows your electronic health record system to talk with somebody else's electronic health record system and to do so securely in order to provide better health care, because you'll have information that you didn't otherwise have. And so that's what we're here to talk about today. This isn't intended to be a very technical discussion, but because a few acronyms come up and I might spit out some jargon, I wanted to just introduce you to the terms. The first one is CCD, which is a continuity of care document, basically a summary of the patient's record. The second one is a CCDA, which is basically the same exact thing. It's just how it gets transmitted into the HIE. EHR, health record, or EMR, some people call it. HL7 is basically the standard that is used to share medical record across systems. So when we build an interface, we comply with the HL7 standards. So you might hear that sometimes, and it's just basically the rules that govern the communication. And finally is OCPRIO. So that's the One California Partnership Regional Health Information Exchange. Is kind of a mouthful, but that's the organization that we've used to coordinate the health information exchange that's being built. Another one that's not up here as far as an acronym, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. One of the side jobs I have at the health agency is I do new hire orientation, where we introduce staff to the health agency and tell them why it's great to work there, what our mission is, and to say they basically made a good decision to join. But it's also an opportunity for me to advertise the programs that we're working on. And one of the things I always ask is, can you tell me what HIPAA stands for? And these are clinicians and administrative folks who have spent a long time in health records, but almost inevitably someone will say it's health insurance. And I might have said information before, because that I often get that one wrong myself, but health insurance portability, privacy. They say privacy, excuse me. They say privacy because that's what we think of when we think of HIPAA. We think of privacy. But the P stands for portability. And when we go back to 1996, when HIPAA was first came out, I think one of the things that stands out is the idea that in the future what we need to do is we need to have portability on all the information that we're sharing, and we need to have that portability be secure. And we need to make sure that we're doing it correctly. And so here we are, 23 years later, and we're still not doing a very good job. We need to get a little bit better at it, and one of the ways that we're trying to do that is through the Health Information Exchange. Just as a bit of an anecdote, I was talking with a coworker recently who gave me a story about her mother, who suffers from dementia. She was recently taken to the emergency room. Because she suffers from dementia, she doesn't have the great ability to describe her medical experience. Mm-hmm. However, part of that includes that she suffers from bipolar disorder. And as a result, she has a negative reaction to steroids and prednisone. The doctor prescribed prednisone, and that induced manic spiral. And this is just the type of story that a lot of people have. You could have replaced that for allergies to antibiotics. But it's just this lack of communication, because that information was available in her primary care physician's basically health record, but they weren't communicating. And so we weren't able to provide the service to that particular person because we didn't have the communication in place. And so that goes back to up above, where we're talking about what is an HIE and improving the speed, quality, safety, and cost of patient care. Those are all important, but the real reason why we're here and why we care about this and I want to spread the word about it is quality and safety. Those are the ones that really matter, and I think that can really be beneficial to what we're doing. So why is it problematic? This is the HIE landscape. So there are over 15 community HIEs in the state of California. The county of San Luis Obispo isn't green here, but because this is a little bit of an older map, but we're green now. That being said, all of those 15 entities do things their own specific way. There's no real standard involved. There's a lot of differences between being a hub-and-spoke model versus being a centralized model on the information they share and how they share it. There's also not a lot of consistency around what we can share or what we're allowed to share. Should we share information about HIV? Should we share information about sexually transmitted diseases? There's not a lot of definition around what is and is not appropriate yet. So there's a lot of fragmentation that happens in the HIE landscape, and that leads us to a challenge within communication amongst each other. However, that's what we're working on. Our goal is to improve that communication and improve patient care. So the history of where this all started, and some of you may be familiar with it, in 2013, there was a decision, I guess at a larger group level, to build a health information exchange, and the consensus was to go with an organization called OCPREA. At the time, they were Orange County Partnership. Now they're One California Partnership. And the three CEOs at Sierra Vista, French, and Twin Cities all signed basically a commitment letter saying that we, in one way or another, want to go forward with OCPREA as being the health information exchange that unites us all together. That was in 2013. And there was a lot of stall between 2013 and 2017. It never really got a lot of movement. There's a variety of different reasons for why this was the case. I think probably the biggest reason was that these were decisions that were made at the executive level, and it wasn't the top strategic initiative, and there were a lot of other ones that needed to take place. And as a result, it just didn't move forward. And so in 2017, I came aboard to the health agency, and Dr. Bornstein asked me to take over the project of reinstituting the health information exchange and moving it along. We did a couple different things in order to make this happen. The first was by turning it into a two-phased approach. So at the time, there was a real big emphasis for having primary care providers as being part of this. And I don't want to take anything away from that, because that is our ultimate goal. But we realized that when we were trying to basically sell the HIE to primary care providers, there wasn't a lot of incentive until there was information available for them. And so what we decided was to break it into a two-phase approach, where the first one is we fill the information exchange with information. And so we brought together CHC, Dignity, Tenet, and the county. And we said, if we can get all four of us, let's make the room a bit smaller and bring the four of us together, if we could get our information on there, then we will have a better selling point so that we could go to the primary care physicians and say, this is worth your time and energy. So that's where we go for step one, and then step two, phase two, is the private practitioners. And that's where we are right now, is transitioning from that phase one to that phase two. I'd like to introduce you to this slide, which is our implementation status. So this is where we stand with the current organizations. You'll notice we have quite a few up here. So Arroyo Grande Community Hospital, basically all of the Dignity hospitals are up, as well as Pacific Central Coast Health Centers, so the primary care physicians that are part of that. CHC, as well as Cottage Hospital down in Santa Barbara, Lompoc Valley Medical Center, and we also have the Public Health Department and the Behavioral Health Department. The two areas where we're still working on and we're pretty close is with Tenet. So Sierra Vista Hospital and Twin Cities Hospital, we're in contract for that. And so I think once we finalize this portion of it, our next goal is to move to that primary care physician category where we can start to say, if you look on the exchange right now, you're going to start to see information, and it's going to be worth your investment. This brings us to the next one, and this is more a slide because this is going to burn your eyes if you try to read it, but this is for you to take home if you want to. This is everyone that Ocprio connects to. So although it's primarily what we're interested in is the County of San Luis Obispo, and the County of Santa Barbara, it does expand broader than that. So Ocprio has a variety of organizations down in Orange County. They also partner with Santa Cruz, the Santa Cruz Health Information Exchange, as well as you'll notice in there too, there's San Diego Health Connect. So there's a lot of organizations that are outside of the County of San Luis Obispo, which was another reason why we went with them initially as being the vendor of choice. Finally, just as far as implementation status, so where are we moving next? The first one is to finalize the contract with Tenet. The second one is to establish a countywide lab interface. So this is almost a secondary project that Dr. James Beebe is working on, but it's in order to connect our laboratories and the information that's available in the laboratories, the orders and the payments, make them connect together. Also, partner with local laboratory and imaging clinics. So I've been on the phone with Central Coast Pathology and Radiology Associates. We're trying to get them on board. That's additional information that I think could be valuable, as well as reaching out to primary care providers, so CCPN, for instance. And finally, just on this list, is our emergency medical services. One of the real values I think that people are going to see almost immediately is if we can get EMS connected. So you have EMS, someone is in an ambulance, the information's put into the ambulance, you arrive at the ER, the information's in your ER so you can pull it out. That's something that you can almost immediately see an impact on the care of our clients. So next, where do we go from here? All right, so this is one idea that has come up recently. As I was talking about a bit earlier, we decided essentially to move away from the executive level movement of the HIE and go more of a worker bee approach, which worked well for us for a while because we got a few people from the key organizations and we just started working and getting stuff done. However, we're moving to the next phase, and one of the ideas that has been brought up by SenCal especially is creating a joint committee. So it's a governance committee that supports both San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties. And basically what a governance committee would be doing would be setting oversight around what the HIE has in it, what information we're sharing, security, and basically the overall future, the strategic vision of it. So efficiency, cost, quality, all of those basic concepts. And that is something that's in place and still needs to be decided on. Who's part of that committee? Whether we should move forward with the committee at all. But these are some decision points that we're dealing with right now. And finally, the conclusion portion of it, what part can you play? So I think this is part where we're moving into right now where the clinician's perspective is pretty key. So as you can imagine, we're a bit of a tech-centric group, and we have a little bit of sway in how technology moves forward through a lot of our organizations, but we are not the drivers. The reason why organizations like the county health organization, why the hospitals make decisions, is because it provides better care to their patients. I can't really say that, but if you see what we're doing is valuable, if you see that something like this could be useful in your clinics, being able to say that to the executives and say, this is something that we want to see move forward, is certainly going to help. As you noticed in some of the slides earlier, some of the information is only singular directional. So CHC, it's only going out. It's not coming in. Mm-hmm. Part of that is maybe you want it to come in. It's not something that I can dictate, but it's certainly something that you could say is something that we want. And the same with Tenet. We're in contract negotiations. The contracts have been going on for a while. But hearing from the clinicians to say, this is something that's valuable, is, I think, going to help leadership make better decisions, or, in my opinion, better at least. So that's the conclusion, and to wrap it up, I'm not sure if you have any questions for me, though. I'm more than happy to take a few.
I'm sure we do have some questions. So Susan, can you use the microphone? Because we don't have Teresa here, so.
Yes. Could you explain the difference here between the bidirectional outbound inbound?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So the way this is set up is, so we have information in the EHR, and then you have the HIE. And if it's unidirectional, so it's only going one way. If it's bidirectional, it's going both ways. So for instance, if we take a look at CHC right now, it's outbound only. So if there's information that's being put into the EHR for CHC, I can see it, we can see it at the county, Dignity can see it, but CHC can't see anything that's being processed over at Dignity or at the county. So it's only going out, it's not coming back in. And similarly with behavioral health at the county, it's coming in, but it's not going out. And we've done that for basically mental health reasons and some security ones, as well as the fact that we're changing our vendor for our EHR system in about a year and a half. And the idea is, well, let's make this big change when we make that change. And so that's for one reason. So both CHC and the county behavioral health, they only have it in one direction.
As you know, right now the CHC went through some major EMR changes. We switched from Next Gen to Athena, so that has been ongoing, kind of, since September last year. So that's probably one of the reasons why we have not implemented bidirectional yet, because that just changing from one completely different EMR to another has been major undertake that's still going on right now. So have you been working with somebody in CHC?
Yeah. So Al Yip and Ryan Yeager are our two counterpoints over there. And, yeah, that was the big challenge. I think it was October, back when you were with, what was it before? It wasn't Athena Health before. It was
Next Gen.
Next Gen, that's correct. And Next Gen, everything was up and running. We were seeing patient records coming through. But that transition did cause some challenges, and also some of the policies are from Athena Health around what they accept and the information that they accept has caused some challenges. So it's not really just, you know, flip a switch and it happens. There's a lot of decisions that have to be made both within organizations like the county or CHC or Dignity, but then as well as the companies we hire. So whether our EHR vendors might have certain things that they expect, and they'll only do it certain ways, and that can cause challenges as well too. That's why we haven't seen as much movement as I guess we would hope to have seen.
So what you were saying with Next Gen, we had a bidirectional?
We did, yeah.
Right, okay, thank you.
I wonder a little bit about counties that have been green longer, that have been doing this a little bit longer. Have they given feedback that can be useful to convince other folks, like how great it is to have this? Do you do some kind of assessment of kind of functionality, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so I'll pull up the green counties.
Or do they, I guess?
Yeah, so they all have different ways that they do it, and they have different information that they share. One of the biggest areas in which we've heard positive information tends to be from the ERs. Mm-hmm. The ERs are the ones where I think they're seeing this impact. I was talking with someone over at Lompoc, and they were saying they got it up and running, and then they had to take it down for a few days. And the feedback from the ER especially was, where did this go? This was so valuable to us because we were getting information about the patients that were coming in, and now it's just gone. And that is, I think, one of the places where people have really seen a lot of the value added from this.
Great.
So let me share with you. I'm an advocate for this full time. So this past week, my 10-year-old grandson was transferred from the urgent care to the ER, and then transferred from ER to the hospital. So by the time he got to the ER, because they're up in Sacramento, and I think they're part of that Sac Valley portion. Yeah. So by the time they got to the ER, the records were there. He was in the ER for a while. By the time then he got to the hospital, everything was there. Totally, everything was there as well. And by the time I took him this morning to his pediatrician, everything was there as well. And it was across three different health systems that he, you know, saw the individual patients. So you're right, the ERs do love it. And I think they're one of them that use it a lot. Now, I can imagine the challenge with private providers that are out there, because they do all have different systems, whether it's NextGen or Athena or Cerner or, you know, one of those. And they've been slow to accept technology to begin with. But it's a great tool and such a sense of having everything there and in front of them, and really does help the quality of care and the way we provide it. So I'll certainly push my provider clients to get on board.
It reminds me of the having to fill out releases of information, sending them over via fax, waiting a couple days, then getting the information back. I mean, that takes a while, and if it's an emergency issue, it's too late.
Yeah. Or even, I think, a lot of what our patients are asking. So when we went to the pediatrician this morning, my daughter had pre-verified everything yesterday online, sent in the little note that said, Grandma's going to bring the kid, and it's okay for her to take the information home and everything. And we walked in, and, of course, albeit our appointment was at 7:15 this morning. But, I mean, we went right into the room and everything. It is very efficient.
Yeah.
Amy.
I do have a quick question for you. First, thank you for providing this information, because I think that there's clear advantages to having information shared on such a broad spectrum. I'm curious, some of the pushback that you mentioned that you're seeing, and if you could speak to what that looks like and what's being done to assure people about privacy concerns and the advantages.
Yeah, it's a good question, because that's where it all comes down to. I mean, I think that's the origin of the challenge, is that your medical information is pretty important to a lot of people, and having it just floating out into the internet is not something that people want. But I think that as a society, we are moving more and more towards the idea of exchanging information and managing or balancing the risk of having that information available and the benefits that exchanging that information have. There are methods that are in place to make sure that we prevent some of the risks from occurring. There are security measures, because basically this is going over the internet. So there are the HL7 standards to make sure that when it goes over securely. And then there's also making sure that when it gets there, that it's being monitored, that people who are using it have the correct level of access to use it. That's one of the reasons we went with the organization we went with, because they do have a monitoring system You can't access any patient unless you are a provider for that patient. The way that you become a provider is entering your name, and there is a way to get around it if, for instance, you're in an ER. But you do have to associate yourself with that patient. You have to give a reason as to why you're putting that information in. But I would say that it's also something that, in my position, working with the EHRs, it's just a general problem that we've had when we moved away from locked paper, that you can see information that you shouldn't see. And we balance that. We often ask ourselves, what should we allow and what do we trust our clinicians to do? And a lot of it is giving the right training. And then with that training, assuming that, or presuming at least, that the clinicians are going to make the right decision. So we give them the tools to understand what is and isn't acceptable, and then to trust. But trust and then verify. We do have a compliance program in place afterwards.
As a actually primary care provider, we actually do share CARE, which has all the vaccine record for people in California. And just having that access has benefit us tremendously. And having this bi-directional information exchange is something that's CHC definitely supports. The communication that I just had with the medical director, as well as the chief of primary care, they totally support it. It's just that it's been delayed because of the Athena. But it's something we definitely want to work with. It saves us a lot of time when we see patients coming from other organizations, whether through hospital discharge or ER discharge, if we don't have to manually go. Right now we have access to their data, but it has to be manually enrolled in there and then sign in and download it. But if we can just seamlessly interchange information, that'll help us a lot of time and more effective in seeing patients.
Jean, anybody else have any questions? Susan.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is really timely and interesting. I have just got some questions because for me, the ER is like, you know, what happens when someone winds up in there and they do have a drug interaction? And, you know, is there a way to just at least have that basic information so mistakes aren't made and the patient's the one that's going to suffer or even be killed, literally? Is there a at least a simple starting point for something like that?
Yeah, I think that actually what tends to happen when we partner with organizations is we start with the world and then we pull it back. So one of the challenges we've encountered at the county is, because yes, the answer is you could really be simple and say all we want is this. But where we started when we did this was, we want everything. We feel like everything that's in there is important. But then we started to ask the questions as well. Well, what are we legally able to share? What are we ethically able to share? As you know, we do a lot of family care work. So there's a lot of sexually transmitted disease information. There's HIV/AIDS. Do we want that to be part of the medical record? So these are complicated decisions that I don't know that there's a great answer to. There certainly isn't a legal answer to. We can share it, but should we share it? But if you pair it back, I think you can make the decision, sure, no, we don't want to share that. We don't really want to share anything except for the basics. The gamut is yours. When we implemented it, you could basically line item out everything that you wanted if you wanted to. Everything except for one thing.
Okay. And the other one I had a nightmare summer a year or so, I think it was last year, with my partner who went through two ERs and a stint in the middle in over in Morro Bay. He had to have some care there. And we ran into some of the most insane stuff because he has a lot of specialists, lots of different protocols and drugs and things. And you get in the hospital and they just don't give you They give you what they have and what they want to give you. And it's difficult to talk between the hospitalist and your primary care physician if they don't have hospital privileges. It was just a nightmare trying to get through all that. And then the same thing happened when he went for the specialty care for a couple months. And then wound up back later after he got home, and then wound up there. And it was just, would this help solve some of this?
I think it might be a step in the right direction. It's not the tool that you could use to communicate as an individual with your care provider. Those ones we're actually working on a separate topic. Patient portals that we're building right now, where through the patient portal you can communicate. There are methods to do that, and within the patient portal too, clinicians can communicate with each other. There's a type of process called Direct, and it's basically an email. In so many words, it's not really email, but it looks and feels like an email, and it's you're able to exchange PHI through that email. And so you log in, you communicate, you say, hey, Dr. So-and-so, this is what we need. And they say, yeah, here you go, here's the CCD. It comes back to you and you can look at it and you can skip all of the other stuff. It's just a communication. That's outside of the HIE, but that is something that we're working toward, at least within the county.
Yeah, good, because it's a nightmare. My other question is, what about, when people get sent to Stanford or UCLA or UCSF, how do those interface?
So that's another good one.
Stanford is on your list.
Stanford is on the list.
Okay.
And one of the things I think that we're starting to see is, if you notice all that stuff that's up in green, they're starting to communicate. They're creating connectivity, excuse me. So OCPRIO is now OCPRIO Santa Cruz HIO.
Okay.
They've merged. And when we looked on the list, San Diego Health Connect has connected. So there's some information that's being shared there as well. And so if you happen to be part of one, you're slowly becoming part of the others. There's still a long way to go. It's not as simple as that, but I think that's the future.
Couple more questions. Another one is, what about veterans and the interface within that system, or is there?
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. It would just depend on whether they're part of one of the organizations already, and if they're not, then no. Okay. If they are, then yes.
Okay.
Actually, I think they're working on that, Susan. That something came across my email today, that the VA just, I think, got some money is what they got to start their health exchange program, and they'll be going out there a little slower than some of our other organizations. But I think they're working on it. But you know, Nick, how long it takes to get to fruition about anything. So
takes a while.
Yeah. Okay, and one last question is, what about, I know there's a lot of people that wind up in the ERs with behavioral health issues.
Yes.
And so what's happening around that? They kind of just are getting sent out the door, or what's the interface there?
That is perhaps the hardest question to answer right now, because I mentioned STDs and HIV. But that's a class that's almost considered separate than mental health issues. And cracking open the door with mental health organizations has been a lot harder, because there is a big stigma around it. And being willing to communicate that information. And Robin's not here, but I know, for instance, with our behavioral health department, we are looking to exchange that information. And you can legally do it. The way that our organization, or the vendor that we've used, does is they have a separate portal. So it's a mental health portal. You can only access the mental health information if you're considered a mental health provider. Now, that's mental health diagnoses, but we talked earlier about the prednisone issue and bipolar disorder. That's considered an allergy. And so the information that you put into that portion of it is exchanged, regardless of whether you're a mental health provider or not. So as soon as you start communicating, you can kind of wall off some of the portions that you feel shouldn't be, and allow some of the other ones to go through, because especially the allergies, I think, is a big one that comes up a lot.
But couldn't you... I didn't mean to interrupt, did I? Couldn't you... For instance, in a lot of the EMRs... So I do remote access chart reviews. So what I see in a lot of the EHRs are the mental health visits are locked. And if I have a legitimate reason for seeing that or whatever, I have to call, sign away my life, and get special permission to take a look at that. So couldn't you use that same walled off concept to protect some of that, and those, if you really need to access that information or share that information, with some additional policy and protocol and whatever, that could be made available?
Absolutely. I think everything is possible. It's just that there is a lot of nervousness about what should be out there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a balance of making people feel comfortable that nothing is being exchanged that shouldn't be. But yeah, it absolutely is possible. We can create all sorts of walls in all sorts of different places. It's just building consensus around where those ought to be.
And I think one of the things that we could do as patients, as far as that goes, is we need to advocate to our providers how important this is. And I know it's hard for them to get on board, but they have to get on board with this.
And I think there was one thing I didn't mention earlier, though. This comes with a cost, so it's not free. And I think right now it's $400 a year for a primary care provider to be part of the exchange. Perhaps in the future there are grants that are available, but that is going to be basically the basic fee for a provider to be part of the exchange.
How about a group provider?
I think the groups will collectively purchase and then divvy out. So
it'd be discounted based on
that. Yeah. And I'm not the salesperson either. I'm just the spokesperson.
So you figure out how many visits that is
and
make it cost effective.
Yeah. Does there seem to be any issue whether patients are, say, Medi-Medi versus private pay or someone that's got really good insurance?
There is no difference at all.
For primary care perspective, we definitely need a mental health data access as well as medical, because I think it's something we talked about in some of the meetings, right? Not having all the information coming in from mental health when patients are referred outside. So that's crucial for us to care for our patient from, you know, mental health as well as the physical, because it's a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, again, thank you, Nick, for coming and sharing with us. I remember from when we were doing the strategic health plan for the next 5 years, the access group health information exchange was one of our goals. So I think we've met two of our goals already on that group. So.
Wonderful.
Good.
All right, thank you all.
All right, thanks. So also this evening we have with us Magdalena Serrano from Community Health Centers, who's going to talk to us a little bit about how they, and she snagged Nick and making him stay, okay. She's going to talk to us a little bit about how they use telepsychiatry. So Nick, can you get the guy from the room back there to help her, or do you know how to plug in here? Here comes our help.
Thank you for having me. I didn't know what the tech specs were going to be, so I figured I would do both. So
let us help you pass them down, okay?
Thank you.
And can you share with Amy? And so I have tomorrow night, we'll share.
Did you get one? Okay.
Thank you.
So one of the things that we see in medicine all the time is telemedicine is becoming very, very not only popular, but patients are wanting it. It always surprises me. I thought maybe patients would be a little ambivalent about the telemedicine. And it's not just our young patients. Everybody. It surprised me that our Medicare patients are one of the biggest population groups or patient groups that really want telemedicine. So go ahead.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Magdalena Serrano. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health and Psychiatry Services for CHC. We are an FQHC network. We span San Luis and Santa Barbara County, 32 clinics. What most people don't realize is that we have made a very strong commitment over the last 4 years to our behavioral health initiatives and the integration of that whole person model of care. So very much speaking to what you're talking about, we've tackled some of the operational challenges that many people face when trying to look at an approach to doing an integrated care model, which includes behavioral health, psychiatry, primary care. There's a multitude of reasons why we have historically not been able to do that, and so the last 2 years has been about all the reasons why we can, how we can, and really navigating that landscape despite the many barriers. So thank you to Dr. Bornstein for having me here, because as a stakeholder in this community, but as someone who hopes to raise grandchildren in this community, I think it's everyone's responsibility to ensure that we have a whole person care model available to everyone, whether they have MediMedi or the best private practice boutique insurance that is offered in maybe Santa Barbara proper. And so the continuum of care is really what we're focused on. So today I'm going to kind of give a brief overview, and then I'm going to dive into what we're specifically doing at CHC. And then I really welcome the opportunity to answer questions, because I think that's where the richness comes in really the experience. Many of which have been adventures. So that being said, I'll go ahead and get started. So to begin with, the overall field of telehealth, it's really important to, I think, define some of these terms. One of the things that I found was very much like Mary's comment, everything that I thought about telehealth was counterintuitive. So everything that I thought, it was going to be distant, it was going to be impersonal, people weren't going to like it, it wasn't going to fit our aging population, it wasn't going to fit kids. I was wrong across the gamut. Everything that I thought was completely wrong. So what telehealth is really a broad term which includes the use of any electronic information and telecommunication technologies to support long-distance clinical health care. It's both patient and professionally health-related education, public health, and it's really important to talk about that, because one of the things we're looking at is how we can use this platform for early intervention and prevention. How can people use telehealth platforms and things kind of like what you were discussing to ensure that they have access to the information. We don't always have to be the one delivering it. People can self-manage, and we need to create platforms in which people simply have access to that information. So telehealth really speaks to a whole person care model. Telemedicine is a subset of telehealth. It includes the subspecialties, much of the ones we're talking about here. Here for our counties, we're utilizing telepsychiatry. We have an incredible shortage of neurology and dermatology in both of our counties, so we use the telemedicine platforms for those two subspecialties. And what we like to do is use a live video conferencing system. In recent years, the term telehealth has risen, and I really like to highlight that because it is a health model which implies that there is healing along a continuum, as opposed to telemedicine where we're just going to manage a symptom and it's sort of a static approach. So why CHC decided that we had to do this is you have to really understand the market drivers and the challenges for the populations we serve. One thing that many people do not realize is the amount of retirees we have moving to the area. That paired with the rising cost of healthcare and the prevalence of chronic diseases, paired with the lack of infrastructure that I think was already noted in terms of lack of hospitals that can really meet people at all of the different triaging levels to really accommodate the large number of patients needed, has created quite a challenge for CHC. Many of you know that what used to look like our level two trauma centers is now our backyard emergency departments. What used to look like emergency department is now being handled in our immediate care. And our wellness visits that one used to be part of primary care now look more like an immediate care facility. So what has that done in terms to access and to the conditions that we're talking about in the long-term management of that? So where we are specifically committed to addressing these concerns is with chronic heart disease, diabetes, chronic respiratory diseases, because many people don't realize these are the leading cause of mortality. But when you start to look at the cross-section and the demographics of our community, there is increasing concern around this, where it intersects with the lack of literacy and health literacy, because then that creates a whole different layer to the challenges that we face. Chronic care management accounts for 75% of healthcare costs. So how can we work smarter given the resources that we have and the shortages that exist? So one of the things that we started realizing as we recruited for CHC is we were getting younger and younger providers coming in, and this new generation of docs brought with them a whole different tech savvy. They were using the internet and using mobile devices and wanting to download apps, and we didn't have the infrastructure, and we were not ready for that. So we had to join the $3 billion market that's out there that acknowledges that the internet usage is part of everyone's daily landscape. And as tragic as it is, we had to accept the fact that there is a 12.9 million provider shortage for primary care providers entering into this discipline. But when you look specifically at some of the rural and remote areas that are served within our counties, this is really punctuated quickly. So we had to think about opportunities to really meet our patients where they are. Home care is a huge element of the continuum of care, and as an ambulatory outpatient setting, we were facing some of the challenges that you raised. How do you take a patient from an ambulatory setting into a hospital where you're not a hospitalist? How do you get access into a skilled nursing facility? Where does the continuum of care end, and how do you responsibly transition people between these levels of care, given that that is the most dangerous time? And given some of the factors that I already noted, that definitely placed our patients in some really high-risk areas. So we looked at the larger global market and found that there was a $2.3 billion investment in 2014 alone for just startups. So tech startups that were looking at the intersection of technology and medicine and how this was going to come together. And we sort of had to humble ourselves and lean in and say, how can we be part of this? And given the same concerns that people were asking, what does this look like with privacy and security? Where's the protocol? How do you address this when the laws have not caught up to technology or what's happening on the ground? And then a radical shift happened, and CMS decided that they were going to cover telehealth. We applied for a grant, and we sort of got dropped in 2014 and began to learn about the culture of telehealth and what you can provide using remote platforms. This is where chronic conditions really need to be managed, and we have a real limit of specialists in the area. So one of the chronic care the chronic diseases that we address at CHC is diabetes, and diabetes and depression have a very strong intersection. Many people don't realize that the third and fourth most common reason people come into CHCs are actually anxiety and depression. So the whole person model actually speaks to the fact that we're leading with behavioral health. And when you look at the impact that has on one's willingness to sometimes engage, the impact that has on one's sort of daily functioning and how that impacts their overall health, we realized that we really needed to look outside of our traditional brick and mortar model and see how we could literally meet the patients where they are. So our investment was in health informatics. We have developed a platform very much in alignment with the one noted above, which has focused primarily on expanding our telemedicine or telepsychiatry services throughout the county. So we have four hubs, and we provide psychiatry services to both our adult and adolescent and pediatric population, specifically in Paso. So we looked at where the overlay was between ourselves and the county, and where there was areas where maybe services were more sparse, and we tried to come in and allow for some infrastructure in those areas where maybe the county has not had an opportunity to create access points. So the idea was to develop access points that complemented one another, given our mild to moderate access. Again, I think often people don't realize the scope, but we are talking about a $34 billion global telehealth market in 2020. So it's not a matter of if or when, it's now. Given the expanding population growth that we continue to see in our county, the reality is simply that we have to look at different access points and truly working that patient-centered medical home to the capacity to really support both patients and providers. I love this image because we would like to think that everyone is working around the patient's needs in the background to ensure that that information that you would like to have remote access to, this is essentially a portal, and that's our dream too. So we invested in an Athena Health Platform, which is more of a registry. And the idea is that in that shared registry, there's a treatment plan of one. So all the different disciplines come together, they share the treatment plan. To Gina's point, I challenge the notion that we should lock behavioral health and mental health diagnoses behind some kind of virtual wall. I think that further stigmatizes, it further silences, and it's why we have the crisis that we have. How can anyone who is not informed of the person's condition actually ever efficiently and effectively treat it? So by removing some of the past stigmas and the past blind spots within the care model, we have found at CHC in the last year that our teams are much more integrated, that our patients are receiving much more compassionate care, that providers better understand and are not labeling our patients as non-compliant or non-adherent. They understand that there are other factors at play that may be impacting their ability to engage up for an appointment, take their medication. And so, you know, I hope that that trend continues to move, because silence equals secret, and secret implies shame. And we're sending that message, whether it's passively or directly, to patients that need to be able to walk into an office and be accepted for everything that is happening that day, whether they're there today because they're having a behavioral health episode and need to be treated for that, or whether they're having challenges managing their diabetes. And so the more that we can see that along the same continuum of chronic conditions, I think the better we will be able to serve our community. For us, this telehealth application has really added to, I think, the bidirectional communication that you speak of. I like to use our pilot site, SloCasa. SloCasa is one of our specialty hubs within CHC, and we use video conferencing, a two-way audio-visual link between our patients, and we provide telepsychiatry suites that also allows the provider who may be located in another annex to pop over and join the conversation between the patient and the psychiatrist, so it's an in-person consult. Again, it allows for that continuity in care and sort of destigmatizes that platform. I'll show you a picture later, and it's set up much like a living room or a traditional therapy environment. We're also starting this year with a store and four technology. We do have 8 psychiatrists within our system. However, 8 psychiatrists are not sufficient to tend to the needs of 110,000 lives. So what we find is often there's a consult that's needed. So with the Storm 4 technology, what we hope to do is be able to take a brief case consult, capture that, have that securely stored in the registry, and then when that provider may have a no-show or a patient cancellation, then they can go switch to a remote platform, review those case consults, and then respond to the provider who may be in another clinic and let them know what the recommendations are based on the presentation that was provided. So your care team is not limited to time, brick and mortar location, and you can still provide that interdisciplinary model. We also have Athena Capture. One of the things Athena Capture does is on that secure network that is web-based, we have a camera. So you can capture an image. Forgive me because I don't know the technology behind like Snapchat, but essentially it disappears. And so it's given for an amount of time. Once the appropriate receiver reads the message, is able to reply, it essentially is gone into some kind of queue. But it does help with that sense of feeling like your information is out there. But I have to tell you, as a behavioral health clinician, when you're trying to convey someone to someone that, no, this patient has completely decompensated and you can't get them to drive and you're not going to put them behind a car, the ability to take a picture to add to the presentation that you're trying to convey can make such a difference. I mean, for me, it has been the difference between a hold or not a hold. And so sometimes helping people to understand what exactly you are looking at in a very three-dimensional manner can be very powerful. For us, we call this model behavioral health integration. Not only do we have the psychiatry piece, embedded clinical social workers, we've also moved to remote patient monitoring platform. What we found is that simply folks needed to be navigated through the system. Many of us would consider ourselves very high functioning, but trying to get an appointment for your loved one or your child or someone or a grandchild proves to be a feat. And when you think of a patient who has to sit on a queue and is holding all of the energy and angst that they're holding while trying to, you know, also advocate for themselves, often they get lost in the system. When you layer that with some of the chronic conditions or behavioral health conditions, you can really see things start to pile up and a patient start to really disengage. So with behavioral health integration, essentially what we have is a behavioral health provider that is co-managing your care. So they act much like a wellness coach. They check in on you monthly and ensure that you're able to meet those goals that you've set forth with your primary care provider. If there is a specific area within your treatment plan that needs some additional support, then they can provide an appointment with a health educator or an endocrinologist or the appropriate specialty to help manage that. What we have found over our last year of piloting, that it has increased access, and it did so in a really interesting way, by helping patients to feel that they are being heard and they are not forgotten. Patients are putting off maybe that visit that they wanted to rush into the immediate care because nobody had followed up with their medication in over a week. Now, because they have that coach that they can count on, that access point is allowed for someone who may need that appointment or really needs to be triaged at that level of immediate care. We are also being able to identify barriers, not what we assume the barriers are, but from our patients. So these are patient-driven metrics. So transportation, we've been able to determine where the areas of transportation gaps are and work with SengHealth to supplement that. So CHC does some of the transporting, and then SengHealth picks up some of it, and then we've been able to contract with other organizations to kind of fill in those gaps. Again, I can't underscore the impact of decreasing shame and stigma. When you can walk in and own your sense of self and feel that the person across from you is able to listen and accept you for who you are, that's what a clinical alliance really is. That's when you build clinical rapport and trust, and that's when you create continuity in care. So we've seen patients definitely retained in a different manner. We're linking patients back to the clinic. Maybe patients who had thought that they were forgotten or no one cared, suddenly they had someone that was navigating, and then they could be brought back to the clinic maybe with a little more comfort. And again, the continuity in care. So if a patient is moved to an inpatient setting, if someone is, you know, transferred to a skilled nursing facility, this person has access to scrub that chart and look at what's happening and provide some really great information. Often that's a social worker, so some of those behavioral health layers and walls aren't there, but we try to really adhere to that title protection and use social workers and RNs for that case management piece, and they can speak that shared speak between the different levels of care. And the one thing that I think I'm the most proud of, it's really started to drive a patient-centric care model where the patients really begin to drive what is important to them. And if you start with that, often you will get a completely different experience. And happy patients equal happy providers. When you see patients leave happy, providers at the end of the day feel like they've accomplished what they were called to do. Because people don't come to work for CHC because of money. They come to work because they have a greater sense of calling. And so we wanted those providers to go home every day feeling like they had accomplished what they had woke up to do every day. We're also working with mobile health. Mobile health is basically any information that's provided through mobile devices. One of the things that often folks don't realize is that many individuals, despite their socioeconomic status, do have phones. And this is often more reliable than using a physical address, often you get all of this mail back. There's a lot of mobility. We have a large population of folks that are not securely housed within both of our counties. Then we also have a special population of migrant folks who, by nature of the work, are moving from different areas. So that really has added to some of the challenges with using the standard mail. So this has allowed us to use targeted text. So we can provide text messages with specific health messages, information, reminders. It's increased our linguistic access. So we can now send this out in our different threshold languages, so Vietnamese, Spanish, English. And then we are currently working to develop some infographics because we do have a Mixteco queue at CHC. So we offer calls in English, Spanish, and Mixteco, and then we have embedded Mixteco interpreters. So this is a really important piece. And for our county, we found that, and the data was about 5 years old, that 68% of individuals have a smartphone within these two counties. And this is also identified as the millennials' preferred mode of communication, hands down. This is our population that is now having children. They would prefer to hear from their pediatrician via text or have an email sent with something followed up. And so that was interesting because we were taking the wrong approach to communication and then wondering why we weren't getting the success rate that we'd hoped for. And so just to illustrate that point, how many people are iPhone users? How many people utilize iPhones? How many of us have virtual or visual security systems and rely on that whenever we're traveling? This is truly a second nature. So what used to seem like something that was really high-tech is really actually quietly embedded in all of our lives. And if we just kind of look around, we can see that this technology is being utilized every single day. Our hope is that by using some of these health informatics that we can start to use the communication, the information technology to improve patient care. And that's really our goal, is to kind of lead that within the county and within the state. This is my favorite example, baby cams and nanny cams. That's basically our most precious commodity. And if you trust this very simple, it's about $110 setup for something as precious as an infant, why can't we think of applying that to so many other spaces and places? Because that's literally all it takes right there. That is the standard setup for a tele-psych piece. It literally, the only thing different is a noise-canceling speaker. And what it does produce is an incredible amount of savings. And I think everyone in this room knows the struggle of trying to take very limited resources and apply them to very complex systems. So just the real world example I give you is if you have a psychiatrist who, hypothetically or not hypothetically, is receiving $320 an hour to provide care, and they have a no-show, that puts that psychiatrist, their support staff, and potentially the front desk person without a patient for an hour. If I could quickly change to remote platform and have them providing support or consultation to another clinic where there is a patient, I am going to reduce waste across the system. But that's something that I can't ask a provider to do. I can't ask someone, hey, jump in your car and drive down to Napomo. And you know what? Now there's a behavioral health crisis in Santa Maria. I need you to head that way 25 minutes. Let's hope it's not lunch. The reality is that's what our system does right now. We chase crisis. We put out fires. We're constantly trying to wait for a hold or this or that. And the reality is it's not efficient and it's not effective. So how can we take these experts to different locations in real time and really utilize the opportunities provided through technology? And just to demystify, this is an example of our Slocasa office, and I just wanted to show you, it's very simple. It's about a $500 setup for the furniture and all of those pieces, but it's not done haphazardly. So here you have a screen. The screen is about at eye level. It's to mimic this idea of sitting and having a face-to-face conversation. All of the colors are blue and gray, and it's about, soothing environments. We try to allow enough space so that the psychiatrist can see the person's full body and really track to determine, if there's any movements or any other side effects that could potentially be happening. We have psych MAs and psych techs on the ground that I would like to think of act as the hands and the heart of those providers. But also they have primary care providers that are co-managing their patients. So when you use this model, the one thing that I will not, really refrain from saying is you really do need a health team. Where you run into risk and concern and some of the issues is when you don't have that patient-centered health home model, because then that provider is left to stand on their own. And that's the worst case scenario for any clinician. You want to be able to work with the expertise of your given care team. And for me, this is mandatory. We require any patient that sees telepsychiatry to also be managed by a primary care provider within our system and be seen on a regular basis. So within the last 6 months to ensure that they're medically stable. And that's just a really important criteria that I think is why you hear some of the bad raps around telemed. And it's because of the management of that. It's not a magic bullet. You have to still work within the scope of what is available through your healthcare system. And then finally, there's just an amount of shared knowledge. There's a reason medicine is referred to as a practice, and it's because they're always learning more and more, and we're always honing our skills, and things are forever changing. I mean, if you look at the opioid crisis or the benzo crisis, what used to be standard of care and best practice 15 years ago is now a crisis. So if we just look at that one snapshot, we realize that knowing that things are forever changing, we need to really utilize the constant stream of information available to us, because if not, our patients will. I mean, they are WebMDing themselves. They're coming and telling you what they're diagnosed with. This is a platform that everybody is comfortable with. Historically, what we're starting to see is it improves no-show rates, provider and patient satisfaction, and it really increases the electronic access, or what we call interoperability, between Dignity, Tenet, our system. We have not connected with the county effectively yet, but we use wonderful people that help to transfer those files. But it is a way to start to create the health information exchange in a way that's the most responsible to our patients and our community. It increases our coordination and care team and improves our outcomes. There are many, many organizations and universities that are far ahead of us. But those of you who are familiar with, you mentioned Stanford and UCLA, they have some of the best integrative models. And I think if we can start to use them as a gold standard and implement even partial versions of those models here in our community, it would be a huge service to those being served, at the different levels of care. And that's it. So, any
Thank
questions?
Thank you. That was a lot of really good information. Questions from anyone? Susan?
Sure. thank you very much. That was very, very informative, and I'm really excited to see the direction you're going. And I personally know that there's some folks that, if it was an emergency, they'll go to the doctor. But now they've gotten hooked up with someone at CHC that they really like. And, and some of the other issues are beginning to get addressed through this whole person approach.
Thank you. Feedback.
Yeah, it's working. It's definitely working. I just wanted to mention, because I forgot to bring my copy in, but I've sent it to the rest of the commissioners, that we have the 2018 health reports where it shows all the different counties in comparison. And as I have been going through that, one of the areas that we really need to work on in this county, because I also have 2002s, and what's happening is our suicide rates are still going up. And so we really need to address the behavioral health issues in this county. And I think that's a great way to backdoor through their health, and then because it's just chronic brain diseases that we're looking at. If we can move around that moral issue, it'll be good. Another question that came up in a discussion with someone yesterday, someone that is very satisfied with their CHC, they've had telehealth and working with someone in the clinics, but they've been having some meltdowns due to some medication interactions and things. Have been becoming a frequent flyer of the ER when I said, why aren't you taking them to the PUF unit? And they said, well, we were told that if they go to the PUF unit, they can no longer be a part of CHC behavioral health. They have to become part of county behavioral health. And the person's not willing to do that because they're very happy with
A little bit about that. So many people don't realize in an ambulatory setting, because of the nature of the model, right? We're not there like after 8 o'clock. We don't have the ability to place a 5150 hold. A lot of the things that you would do for a person in crisis, right? IM medication, we don't have the capacity to do. So it sets up a really unfair expectation for the patient to assume that we can provide that level of care. What our belief is, someone needs to be stabilized in a PUF unit, that there's probably a good chance that they're going to need their medication stabilized. They're going to probably need some of that higher level or higher acuity level of care, probably wraparound care, to get them back to that place where they're feeling a little more stable and in that mild to moderate continuum. So that is more of a decision around providing safety for patients when they may not be in a state to determine whether or not that is the best decision for them. And I really say that because one of the most challenging things in the whole world is having someone start the process, be destabilized, come back at the inappropriate level of care, and think that they're going to get a different outcome. And so every time we do that, we're actually disengaging that patient and robbing them of a little bit of hope. I would much rather make the error of placing them at a higher level of care and providing too much service and wraparound than failing and being loose and then being part of that statistic that you're referencing. Because what often people don't realize is suicide isn't about wanting to die. It's about wanting to stop suffering. But suffering is often associated with pain. And one of the greatest pains ever is feeling like you're not getting better. And if I leave you at the wrong level of care, you're going to think you're doing something wrong, but that somehow you're not getting better. And I'm not going to be the one to rob anyone from their sense of hope, right? And so that's really where that decision is founded. And it's really making sure that we are not, because we think it might be the greatest thing or the most comfortable thing right now, not looking at that continuum. Because I hope that everyone gets to a place where they can be seen and managed by their primary care provider. But I appreciate you asking the question because I think there's some misunderstanding around where that is. And it really comes back down to the fact that if you can't do a hold, is it really the safest thing for you to be placing patients that would probably require that in a setting? Because Gina would be the one trying to get them stable at 7 o'clock at night, and she can't do a hold. She's going to call me. I can't do a hold. So there's two people now that are probably activating the situation, and that's what it really looks like. So, yeah.
Right. So am I understanding here that if they then say the ER, would they refer them for a 5150, and then at that level of care, then they could come back to their CHC provider?
After 6 months, because we want to ensure that they're stabilized, right? So if you go into crisis to the point where you're requiring to be hospitalized for 72 hours, I'm going to make a default assumption that there needs to be some adjustments to your treatment, whether it be medication or behavioral. So by the very nature of those two interventions, that person would not be stable at that level of care. The other thing is that our model is designed for a behavioral health integrated model, in that we're seeing patients maybe every 2 to 3 weeks. These are folks that are coming in with maybe an adjustment disorder, anxiety, depression. We want to be part of the bigger scope of really that mild to moderate early intervention prevention continuum. We keep looking at behavioral health as a starting point of crisis, and that's where we fail ourselves. So crisis and acute in the SMI population, county is given funding to provide that service to a tight population. We are required to take care of that other 110,000 that hopefully are going to need that support for 3 to 6 months, right? Life happens, you get stabilized, you go back to your baseline and come back. That's really our wheelhouse. To say that we're doing something out here would just be irresponsible, and that's really the part. Okay. it's not about our clinical capacity. It's about our infrastructure and our overarching responsibility to the community. And I think that's where I have psychiatrists that could manage anyone. But I don't want them to do that in this system, because the system is not set up for that. And that's the delineation. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was a lot of information. I'm really blown away, and I really appreciate your really holistic philosophy. The whole person philosophy that you presented was awesome. I'm not sure if I have a very well-formed question, so I apologize. But it seems like you've spent a lot of time and been very intentional about thinking about capturing everyone that you possibly can capture. And I wonder, who do you worry about that you're missing? And then, I guess, off of that, what do you think the future holds for this program?
Oh, I think it's a great question. So I know who we're missing. We're missing our adolescents. We're missing our tweens. And my thought early on, because we had limited resources and I've only been with CHC for about 4.5 years, was I can stabilize more kids by stabilizing their parents. If there's one kid that's not stabilized, I probably am going to say that there's a few more. And so if I got mom and dad stable, or if I got one parent stable, I was going to do more for the overall well-being of that child. So we really focused on our adult population. Once we were able to kind of stabilize that population, what we started to do, and we, in the last 7 months, we started to look at our adolescents. Much of that was driven by the suicide attempts in both counties. And so that is our current focus. It is 100% where we're headed in 2019. We're continuing to move forward. We have brought on 3 clinicians that are specifically focused on the adolescent population. But it's a tender place for me, because once I do get those kids, I still have to send them home to a home that might not be stable. And I grew up in one of those kind of homes. And one of the worst things you can do to a child is make them aware of the dysfunction, of the lack of support, of the challenges they face every day, and essentially deconstruct what you cannot reconstruct. But so many people do that. But they're not going to stay in that child's life. They're going to be there for 3 months or 6 months or whatever the managed care allows, 10 visits. And I just don't think that's the most responsible way to address this. So what we're trying to do is develop a system and really partner with SenCal. And I'm really thankful they have a new provider who has really championed long-term treatment. To me, short-term for an adolescent or child is 18 months. Kids don't even know you. They don't like you. They barely start trusting you when it's 18 months. So you have to be really in it for the long haul. So that's really where we are. Because if we started the program 6 months, that means I am looking at a commitment to that first 150 kids for the next 4 years at minimum. We try to get them to that threshold. But it is really hard, because kids under 13, we run into a whole lot of issues around consent. If that family system is not healthy and stable, it's very likely parents aren't going to get you to your appointment. It's very likely parents aren't going to fill your prescription. It's very likely that there's going to be a whole lot of reasons why I can't get you in to see the doctor, let alone if there's abuse or violence. They're not going to want that child to be seen by multiple eyes. So it is very complicated, but it hands down is, I think, where we're headed this year and next year. It's single-handedly our kind of a commitment to the community. So, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for the presentation. Fellow social worker. So I totally get the language. Just a couple questions that I was curious about. With the behavioral health integration, and you've got these health wellness coaches, essentially, who are checking in monthly, how do you bill for that? Do you bill for that?
That's a great question, yeah.
And who's staffing that? Are they social workers? Are they RNs?
So it's probably the thing I'm the most excited about, because generally social workers don't have the best business acumen.
Right.
People like to say we're more heart than head. I would say that there's a place in the middle. So CMS in 2018 provided an initiative, given the fact that they knew that most of the aging population had chronic conditions, that allowed for remote platforms. So the remote platform says that if a provider, so someone with a master's level or higher in social work, was providing what they called behavioral health integration, medication and integrating someone with a behavioral health diagnosis and another chronic, or just a behavioral health diagnosis that was part of this population, that they would reimburse for this service for 20 minutes or longer once a month. And for me, knowing that we had patients in Yokoyama, Los Alamos, I was like, we need this, San Miguel. So that's when we started engaging. So it is billable. The reimbursement rate is about $68. It's for a Medicare paneled provider. But again, I caution that CMS is wanting that integrated care model. So they want to make sure that there's a primary care provider. There's all of these elements. The other thing that I caution people with is it really isn't about the financial model of it, because 20 minutes of a social worker on the phone means that they just identified four other needs that patient has. So essentially now you're just going to need to schedule the person with their primary care provider, refer them for a lab, and all of these access points that if you're in a silo or in a system of one, it doesn't really work. So that is the remote platform. And then we also are venturing into that with other managed care options, and those are going to be billable. And I expect that everyone's going to follow in line with CMS. So they sort of do it first, and then everyone else follows. And the code is a GEO511 if you want to check it out, because I think sometimes having someone done the work, you can move into that. But it is for the Medicare CMS population.
Thank you.
And title protection, you want a nurse or a social worker to do it.
Yeah.
Because we use that so loosely, and that's where things get really watered down and dangerous. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then one other question.
Sure.
Are all of sort of your remote team, the people who are designated to do telehealth, are they all local here, or are they coming from within the two counties? And the reason why I ask is just generally, since we know we have an issue with providers versus the number in our populations, is there opportunity to be able to pull in from other counties to be able to help people within the counties that we're serving?
Yeah, so I would say that is the hardest part, is the recruitment. So specifically, I can speak to the psychiatrist. I'm not involved in the recruitment of the other specialties. They're not locally. They don't live locally. So they are from the Bay Area, San Diego, San Francisco. It took us a year of truly courting them almost to really bring them here. We were looking for what I would consider unicorns. We were looking for Spanish and psychiatry. So we have Dr. Alvarados. He's a triple board certified neurologist psychiatrist. He speaks Spanish and he gives fist bumps on the screen at the end of his sessions. So he's kind of like a Pegasus. I wish that there was them to share, but the hours I get with them, I mean, at this point, they have 10 offers before they even graduate. We are looking at vetting someone who's in school right now. So it is very complicated, but I'm open to like joining forces with other organizations to maybe split the cost of these providers. I think we have to think outside of the box, especially when you think of remote platforms. 20 hours a contract one with one organization, 20 hours with another. You're serving the same community. It's very, very complicated. And then there's a lot of legal implications of making sure that your provider is not from another state. And then there's issues with medication. So like little kids who maybe need a stimulant medication, you have to have separate DEA license for your provider, separate DEA license for your buildings, special consent. So it's complicated. Doable, but it takes some time and commitment. So, no, really good questions. And it's kind of one of the reasons I was thankful to come and share, because I know the struggle and the frustration and the challenges. And, you know, you don't even know you did it wrong until you're about to hit the start. So anything we can share, though. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much. And, you know, we actually have an amazing behavioral health department, thanks to you. And the care at primary care, we have a seamless care for the patient. We share the data with our behavioral health department. That include medication concerns and whatnot. So it's really safe. I prefer my patients be taken care of by our behavioral health rather than sending them outside. But as you know, because of the insurance and acuity levels that we do have to send out, and not having that information, it's been kind of challenging for the primary care. Talking about adolescent psychiatry, I believe that we have a psychiatrist who actually handle children, which is probably he's the only one in the county, I believe.
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. We have.
Because normally we were sending them out to Santa Barbara County. So that's another.
So we have the pediatric, mm-hmm. who's Dr. Alvarez, and then we have Dr. Nicole, who's adolescent, and she's in Guadalupe. So a lot of people don't realize in Guadalupe we have an adolescent psychiatrist, and that's because it's like a central point. And so we have the adult and adolescent together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Thank you for coming tonight. I don't have questions. I thought that was really thorough, but I do have some comments.
Please.
I had the great pleasure of being a part of a telemedicine clinical trial in Colorado for diabetes and seeing the impact of what that brings to a patient, to the family, to the provider, to link people together when they're so spread apart, and seeing the clear advantages of having something like that. So it's great to see that this has become so vast in our neighborhood and our communities. And I got the pleasure of touring the telepsychiatry facility in Guadalupe, and it's phenomenal. So I thank you for being here tonight.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you both for being here this evening. It was very enlightening. You all had good questions as well. And I think that we're very lucky in our county to have the services that they do. So good luck with
thank you all, and thank you
going
for advocating
forward with for that integrated behavior health. We appreciate it very much. Thank you, Nick, as well.
Have a good night.
Okay. All right. So Dr. Borenstein is with us this evening, and she will do our health agency report, please.
Thank you. This over a week's time, we are being presented with the state budget and the county budget. So last Thursday, I think, the governor released his May revised budget, which I have to say was Christmas in May. The state is doing phenomenally well economically, and so regardless of your political persuasion, I think there was something in it for everyone in that. The reserves are being contributed to significantly, and I know for fiscal stalwarts that's always a concern, is there were a lot of budget proposals related to giving out quite a bit of money, but at the same time it was really good to see that there was quite a bit added to the reserves. As I told my staff earlier today, up to $16.5 billion in state reserves, that there are a lot of countries on the planet that probably would kill for that as their total GDP. And California is looking to that for their reserves. But there was also quite a bit in there that will directly relate to the work that we do. So the Health Officers Association of California, in concert with the County Health Executives Association of California, had asked for $50 million of state general fund for communicable disease control. And the governor put in $40 million, so not bad. That the importance of that is, as was demonstrated during the initial budget hearing on that piece of the proposal, is that statewide local health departments have never recovered from the Great Recession of 2008 in terms of our basic realignment funding, which is pretty much in smaller counties and even counties of this size, is almost all that we get for communicable disease control. Some of the larger counties get federal dollars for things like HIV or for tuberculosis, straight up grant funding, STDs, there's now money in that. We don't get any of that. So for us to be able to get an ongoing dedicated stream of money to fight whatever disease du jour may come up, whether it's hepatitis A or STDs that we continue to see on the rise, flu, what have you, will be a really important component of our funding structure, and hopefully the legislature will go ahead and approve at least that much. Also, we saw an infusion in the governor's proposal to the tune of $23 million for home visiting, so for high-risk pregnant women in early childhood. This is in addition to the CalWORKs money that the legislature put in at the beginning of this year, so we're hopeful that we may be in a position to apply for that. There's also going to be, and I didn't write down the dollar amount, but quite frankly, I don't know about you, but when I start hearing in the tens of millions of dollars, I have no idea what that means locally. But a good amount of money to actually provide training to pediatricians and family practice docs who see kids on ACEs screening, and ACEs being adverse childhood events. I don't know what the S is, but adverse childhood events, plural, S, as we're learning more and more. This is sort of 20-year-old data, but it's finally under our Surgeon General, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, as well as our governor, giving it the attention that it deserves, that it's not just affecting children when they have tumultuous homes at the time of their childhood, but that we actually know now that it goes on to have chronic health effects. So who would have thunk that domestic violence or divorce or substance abuse in your childhood home would actually have not just the stress-based implications, but actual change in the health patterns of the physiology of that person to lead to heart disease and other types of things that are, you know, destined for chronic disease. Is probably why, as you've heard around this table many times, you know, people with mental illness or substance abuse disorders often die 25 years younger. And it's not just because of, you know, them walking in front of a car because of the mental illness or overdosing. It's because of the chronic illnesses that come with these things. So anyway, I know I'm preaching a bit, but on the health care access front, there was also some amplifications where the proposal to expand to undocumented residents to the age of 26 for full-scope Medi-Cal is in the budget, as well as expanded subsidies under Covered California. So the amount of subsidy going to people at all levels, which is basically 200 to 400% of the federal poverty level, but also expanding who gets subsidies up to 600% of the federal poverty level. So those were some of the key takeaways from the budget process at the state. Tomorrow is the unveiling of the county's budget for fiscal year 19-20. It's available now publicly, and as far as the health agency and the public health department is concerned, there's really nothing of consequence in one direction or the other. So we're not growing, we're not cutting, we're pretty status quo, and you know, that's pretty good news. I did want to talk a little bit about communicable diseases because they've been in the news a lot lately. Thankfully, we have not had a measles case, but we're, you know, becoming somewhat surrounded. So hopefully all the other counties who are doing some very aggressive work at isolation and quarantine measures and really amplifying their vaccination efforts, et cetera, will bring this under control. But you know, the national number is well over 700 now, and the state number is over 40 now. So we haven't seen these kinds of numbers in almost 20 years. So far, so good in our county, but we're staying on high alert. And I mentioned this already about the STD rates going up in our county. We had the opportunity, our leadership team in communicable disease, myself included today, to have a training in Santa Maria on what's actually going on in looking at local data and statewide data and related to STDs. And it's really quite remarkable. I mean, we're lucky again in this county, but some of our very close neighboring counties are seeing in the dozens annually of congenital syphilis. You know, that was gone again 20 years ago. So this is the life of a public health professional, is that these things do tend to come and go. And so as far as communicable diseases, we're just in a pretty low place right now, and we'll keep trudging ahead and doing everything we can to control it. But that, yet again, another reason that the finances will help us to really supplement our prevention efforts. And finally, I did want to just mention one thing, is this is Bike Month, and the Health Department, as part of our Health Promotion Unit, is, along with Parks and Recs, is sponsoring a Bikes and Bites County Bike Breakfast this Thursday morning, May 16th, from 7 to 9 a.m., so you not only have to get up early because it takes time to bike, but that's when breakfast is going to be served. So some burritos, fresh fruit, coffee, all free. Ride to the county courthouse this Thursday morning, and show your support for Bike Month, and get a healthy breakfast at the right across the street from where we are at the Slo County Courthouse. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you. Thanks.
Any questions for Dr. Bornstein?
Good, good. Actually, a lot of good news this month. All right, starting with Health Commissioner updates. Susan, let's start with you.
Well, I don't know. Plenty has been said about the Homeless Services Oversight Committee. Mm-hmm. They've some of the choices that were made for that HEAP funding. Mm-hmm. So it's been in the news and in the paper, and so I'm sure we'll be hearing more. And but there's supposed to be more funding coming down from the state in this late summer, early fall, and maybe with the new budget revised, there could be even more funds. So hopefully we could pick up some of those other programs that weren't funded in this particular go-round. And it'll be interesting to see what happens for South County and what they can put together.
It has been a vocal group.
Yes.
Candace?
I don't have a committee update, but if it's okay, I'd like to brag about my students' work in the community.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So,
go ahead.
The 33rd Annual Presidential Community Service Awards are happening at Cal Poly this week. And two student clubs that were involved with outreach in the community, with the county and with working to fundraise for 40 Prado, are getting an award. So the Pre-Med Club and the Pre-Dental Club and the Emergency Medical Services Club are all together hosting a glow run for 40 Prado. That's June 1st.
What's it's the glow run?
I don't know. You glow. You run and glow.
Oh, like a paint thing? They throw the...
Sort of. It's at night. It's on campus.
You got to go to the dollar store more.
There's like light up things. Right. I think they have black light. Yeah. It sounds cool. Mm-hmm. And all of the money that they raise for it is going to go to 40 Prado. In addition, the Pre-Dental Club has been doing outreach into the community at the elementary schools, and so they also got a little award. And then my students that work with the naloxone distribution program at the county jail are also getting a service award for a significant contribution to the community. So I'm proud of all of them.
You should be. Wonderful. Yeah. Congratulations to all of them. Yeah. Tamar?
Just one quick update. The SART team is holding another training for trauma-informed responses to sexual assault. It'll be a half-day training. It will be $25. It'll cover lunch, and it will be at Cuesta.
Okay. Good. Jean?
Thank you. I attended the Adult Services Policy Council meeting on the 5th, the 3rd, and it was the Independent Living Resource Center. They gave a presentation of all their resources, and at the end they were talking about, are you passionate about working to create housing that is affordable and accessible in Slo County? And they're looking to be an advocate as well. And they will be meeting on June the 11th, so if anyone's interested, they could contact the Independent Living Resource Center. Also, there was an announcement from Wilshire Health and Community Services. They're giving a presentation on I guess it's an aging project. We're changing the way and approach aging in isolation. That's Thursday, May the 30th, from 11:30 to 1:30. So if anyone's interested, it's actually going to be at the Villages of Slo. And the last thing I need to just make a mention of, I attended the Food System Coalition meeting this morning that was held at French Hospital. That's where they were meeting, but they were looking at food access for seniors. And it was nice to see they had presentations by Kate Lauterbach talking about CalFresh, Dave Kuykendall from Slo Villages, and Julianne McAdams about the Meals That Connect. So those are all the ways and all the people. The networks was really nice to see all the people in our community looking at some of the needs of the seniors.
Good. Thank you. Gina?
I have nothing to report, but okay. I just want to comment, talk about measles. At the primary care, we are giving a lot of measles vaccines. Yeah, a lot of people are coming in asking for titers, which is to see if they have immunity, and they're getting vaccine. Even they're even going away to Disney trip. They want to come in making sure they're vaccinated and they're immune.
That's the place to do it. Yeah. Good. Thanks. Amy? And Amy, when you give your report, tell us a little bit about your new job.
Sure. So I attended the Heal Slo Healthy Communities work group on May 2nd. We looked at a couple different projects to review, but the one I wanted to mention was the 660 Tank Farm and 3985 Broad, so the corner of Tank Farm and Broad Street across from Marigold Shopping Center. And they're looking for they're looking to build full care assisted living and dementia care and shopping centers. And part of what we discussed at our meeting was to ensure that there are health concerns accounted for in the inherent design. So improving the walkability within the actual center to account for it being outdoors. So knowing that people are going to be walking around outside, and if there's a potential shopping center, how can they account for safety outside? Discussed the potential for a pedestrian refuge in the middle of Broad Street, considering how large it is, if people are going to be crossing. We don't want them not to feel like they can cross or get stuck halfway. And then addressing some of the traffic buildup and concerns, it would be a right turn in, so accounting for safety of pedestrians and cyclists, whether they're just commuting or traveling, and as well as if there's going to be a shopping center, large 18-wheel trucks coming in and idling, and some of the air pollution concerns were discussed. So I believe they put in some recommendations for those concerns as well, and those were under review.
And the new job.
Yes. So I have taken a position with the American Diabetes Association, serving as the Youth and Family Initiatives Manager in the West Territory. Staying locally and Slo and still supporting the Health Commission and being involved in different ways as well.
Good. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
I just have a couple of things. I did start attending the Human Trafficking Task Force. I relieved Commissioner Campbell on that one. I was surprised. It's a very large task force now. There must have been 35 people in the room. FBI from the Santa Maria office, all kinds of health care providers, service organizations, and what have you. One of the things that they were mentioning, they are working, the NOR Clinic and Cal Poly have a mobile van now that will start to go out to the fields. And so they're trying to come up with a sensitive way and a sensitive
advocate or counselor person, whatever, to try so that we can start to look at human trafficking that may be going on in the workforce. Currently, they're working with a lot of the massage parlors in the county and what have you, but it is certainly an active task force. The other thing I just wanted to mention is in our packets tonight, we have an updated list to the liaison to the advisory bodies, and I see that there's a couple of errors on this, so don't permanently put this. Well, I'll have Teresa make those changes. And also, we have an updated health commissioner roster, and I'm thinking, Amy, this is not your address, right? So I will ask Teresa to update those when she gets back and have her email them out to all of us. Also, just wanted to let you all know that in next month's meeting, we should seat our newest commissioner. And with that, the commission will be fully seated, vested, whatever we call ourselves. So anyway.
Full complement.
We will have a full complement of commissioners. That's right. Also, to remind you that it's only a couple of months until we have our next planning retreat. So be thinking about what you'd like to tackle next year, hear about next year, because we'll be looking for suggestions there. And with that, that's all I have this evening. Anybody else have anything that they would like to talk about or bring up? If not, we'll be adjourned until June. Thank you all.